From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. While the number of childhood cancer diagnoses has increased over the past couple of decades, the patient survival rate has also increased dramatically. We'll hear one survivor's story as we explore the long-term health effects of childhood cancer and its sometimes aggressive treatments. The Golisano Children's Hospital hosts a conference on the topic later this month. Plus, what could going green do for your business? Ahead of the Florida Department of Environmental Protection's Greening Your Bottom Line Conference and Expo, we'll explore green innovations that can be adopted by businesses from a broad spectrum of industries, as well as partnership programs that already exist at the state and local level. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. How can going green affect your business? That question is at the center of the Florida Department of Environmental Protection's Greening Your Bottom Line Conference and Expo later this month in Fort Myers. We'll talk about green innovations for businesses as well as state and local partnership programs to encourage more businesses to adopt green practices. That's coming up in about half an hour. But first, we're shining a spotlight on childhood cancer. Over the last two decades, the mortality rate of children diagnosed with some form of cancer has reduced dramatically, even as the rate of new diagnoses has increased. The Golisano Children's Hospital of Southwest Florida holds its first Pediatric After Cancer Experience, or PACE, conference to address the long-term health effects and unique needs of those young patients who survive. The free conference takes place Saturday, October 19th. Joining me now by phone from Miami is one of the PACE conference keynote speakers, Dr. Daniel Armstrong. He's a professor and executive vice president of the Department of Pediatrics at the Mailman Center for Child Development at the University of Miami's Miller School of Medicine. Dr. Armstrong, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, John. Thank you.
Also with us is advanced registered nurse practitioner Pam Wojcicki with the Department of Pediatric Hematology and Oncology at the Golisano Children's Hospital. She also coordinates the hospital's Pediatric After Cancer Experience Program. Pam, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Also with us in studio this morning is childhood cancer survivor Julie Briggs, who was first diagnosed with cancer at the age of 10. She's a child advocate instructor with the Golisano Children's Hospital and will be sharing her story at the PACE conference later this month. Julie Briggs, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you for having me.
And I invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. If you or a loved one has battled a childhood cancer diagnosis, give us a call. Tell us about your story. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or comment on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Julie Briggs, I did want to start with you. Just tell us a bit about your story first. I know you're in your mid-20s now, and as I mentioned, you were first diagnosed when you were 10. Take us back to that day when you were first received the diagnosis.
I was diagnosed with ALL leukemia in 1997. So I was 10 years old, totally unexpected, out of the blue. And Dr. Salmon and his staff had actually just came to the hospital, I think, a couple months earlier, so I was very lucky to not have to travel like many of the patients did before me.
And Dr. Armstrong, she says ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, is that a common form of cancer for children to be diagnosed with?
It's actually our most common form. Leukemias make up about 30% of the total diagnoses of childhood cancer. Fortunately, ALL is one of the cancers that we've had the greatest success over the last 30 years. Resulting in a cure. When I started in the late 1970s working in the area, our survival rate was in the neighborhood of about 30%. Today, for the most favorable types of ALL, we're looking at a long-term survival and cure rate of about 90%.
And what other forms of cancer are commonly diagnosed among, child patients?
Well, after leukemias and lymphomas, the next biggest group are children who are diagnosed with tumors of the central nervous system or brain tumors. And then after that are a whole bunch of different types of of solid tumors that can be in the bone, the different sarcomas, muscles, eye tumors, and the like. A lot, some of these have a genetic basis, but most we don't really know what the cause is.
And for those ones that perhaps pose more of a challenge to treat or maybe require more aggressive treatments, is that where we see more physical problems for those patients down the line, more medical issues that can develop?
Well, it's an important point to recognize that it's not just the intensity of the treatment, but it really is some of the specific components of treatment. And one of the fortunate things that, and it's really good to hear Julie online, one of the fortunate things that we have is that a lot of our children who are survivors because we have done clinical trials and we've learned new drugs, new radiation therapy approaches over the last 20 years, combining medications in different combinations and administering them in different ways. And what we know is that we've gotten this great improvement in survival. Now more than 75% of children diagnosed with cancer are really expected to be long-term survivors into adulthood. But what this does is it sometimes interferes with the growth of a child's growing body, and that can affect the brain, the muscular skeletal components. We have children who short stature, who don't grow to be as tall. We have the things that I work primarily in, the effects on the brain and cognitive and learning function. We can have reproductive issues. There's a whole list, a long list of potential long-term effects of this treatment, and many of them are very specific to whether a child gets radiation or not, whether they get a specific drug or not.
Okay, and we're going to get into some of those effects in just a little bit here. But Julie, I wanted to come back with you. You know, as a 10-year-old, do you think you really understood the gravity of the diagnosis? Or I guess what I'm asking is, how do you think you or any child perhaps takes that diagnosis versus just how an adult processes that information?
When I was first diagnosed, I don't think I fully understand it. Did I fully understand it ever at that age? I'm not quite sure. But when you're kids, I feel like you're a little more resilient. And because you don't fully understand maybe what's going on, that actually helped me just to continue to live my life and enjoy what was going on in my life. And it was just kind of a bump in the road at the time.
How invasive was your treatment, or how much did it alter your ability to just be a normal kid?
When I was first diagnosed at 10, it really didn't affect my life much. I was going to school and I was going into the clinic for my chemotherapy treatments. So I was still pretty active. Every once in a while I was down because of the intensity of the treatments. But for the most part, I remember I was pretty active as a kid and still basically going to school as much as possible.
And you kicked the ALL, but that wasn't the end of your story either.
No, I was I relapsed in 2001 at the age of 14, going into my freshman year of high school. So we took a different treatment route than when we had found out that I had relapsed.
What was the treatment route that time around?
We decided to do a bone marrow transplant. We went up to Duke Medical Center to do that.
And it's been 12 years since then. Do you suffer any kind of health effects or mental or physical health effects as a result of this now, even all this time later?
Over time, I had a lot of cognitive stuff going on, kind of education stuff, learning problems. But overall, just minor medical stuff that we think is due to the radiation, the chemotherapy, and the other treatments I've gotten along the way.
Okay. We're talking with childhood cancer survivor Julie Briggs, along with Dr. Daniel Armstrong with the Mailman Center for Child Development with the University of Miami's School of Medicine, and also with us nurse practitioner Pam Wojcicki with Lee Memorial Health System's Pediatric Cancer Aftercare Program. They'll all be at the Golisano Children's Hospital's first Pediatric Aftercare Experience Conference, or PACE, later this month in Fort Myers. You can join our conversation with your story of childhood cancer with a phone call to 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, or send email to GulfCoastLive@WGCU.org. And Julie, are you still involved in follow-up care, through the program that Pam here coordinates?
Yeah, I've seen Pam over the last couple years, several years, just to check in and see how my progress is going with those minor medical stuff that I deal with today.
And tell us again about what some of those are. I know we'd mentioned earlier on the phone a weakened immune system, thyroid problems, just fatigue.
Yeah. Overall, I just tend to be a little more tired. I've learned to deal with that, though. It's just, you know, this is me now. And a lot of other things, a couple other things like gastroparesis that we all think is due to, like, the radiation or the treatments I've gotten.
And Pam, is this kind of follow-up care, is this something you do with all childhood cancer patients?
Mm-hmm. The program that we have at Golisano Children's Hospital, we see all patients basically that are survivors of pediatric cancer. A lot of them have been treated at our institution. Some of them have been treated elsewhere because there haven't been a lot of programs that have defined late effects programs. You know, early on in the course of treatment, not enough children survived in order for there to really be a focus on late effects. Obviously, the focus early on was just trying to keep patients alive and help them survive. Now that our survival rates have gotten much better through all the clinical trials that most pediatric patients are enrolled on, now that's becoming more and more of an issue. And so there's good news. You know, most patients survive and have minimal effects, but some patients do have sometimes maybe one, sometimes multiple long-term effects related to their therapy. And so it's helpful to have a program that is focused on what those potentially could be. And so the program that we have at the Golisano Children's Hospital, and there are similar programs throughout the state and also through the country, are geared towards focusing on those pieces as opposed to worrying about disease recurrence. So patients will usually enter long-term follow-up after they're at least 2 years off therapy. Some programs have a little bit different rules as far as when they accept patients into those programs. But the focus is on trying to coordinate their care so that that way they're not missing lots of school and lots of work, going to multiple physicians' appointments. You know, we try to help coordinate all of that so that that way there's one person looking at the big picture as opposed to the subspecialist who only pays attention to the cognitive issues or only pays attention to the GI issues or only the endocrine issues or whatever the issues might be dependent on that particular person's story.
And a typical primary care physician just might not have the expertise to really understand, you know, the link between the symptoms and the treatment that the patient had or the type of cancer they had.
Right. There's significant knowledge deficit, not only in the healthcare provider, but also in the patient's realm. There's been studies that have looked at what patients understand about their treatment, and a lot of them don't know what they received, don't know what they got, don't have any idea what those potential long-term follow-ups are. So a big part of our role is to educate, to provide treatment summaries, so that as patients like Julie, you know, grow up and become adults and have lives and probably move away from a home,
right,
that they are empowered with the knowledge they need in order to be able to help navigate their own health care. We do a good job in pediatrics of hand-holding families and telling them what they need. That is not the experience in the adult world.
Right.
The patient is the one who has to really navigate that healthcare system. And if they don't know what their potential risks are, what they need to be doing to monitor their health and to maintain their health as well as they can, then we haven't done them a service if they don't know what's expected and what the recommendations are. So that's our job, is to not only give them a summary of what they've had, what the exposures are, but to help educate them and try to make sure we support them to get those services they need.
I think it's interesting, Pam, because I know you work on both ends. Like, you're working with the kids who are actually going through the treatment, and then you're working with, you know, adults who were in that position maybe just a few years before. Do you ever work to link the two? Maybe bring a survivor in to you know, maybe talk to the kids who are going through the same thing just to say, hey, I've done this too?
Well, our program, we integrate both. We don't have we do have a defined late effects clinic, but we still physically do it in the same clinic.
Sure.
And so there is a lot of interaction between not only just coming to the clinic, but also programs we do and things we do outside of the actual treatment facility. So there is quite a bit of interaction. And so some institutions actually have very different, I mean, you literally, once you graduate to long-term follow-up, you're physically seen by different people in a different location. And so some of those are unique to the different places. But in our case, we actually still integrate both. So they do tend to interact with each other.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Armstrong, I know one of your specific areas of expertise and research interest, as you've mentioned, is in the neurocognitive effects of childhood cancer. I was hoping you could tell us more about, you know, those symptoms and how and why they manifest.
Sure. I think when we began working years ago, the real focus was on just making sure that children got treated and survived their cancer. And over the years, we've begun to see that with that success, many of these children began coming into us, and their parents would say, well, you know, they're not doing so well in school, or we're having problems with this, that, and the other. And as we have developed new treatment protocols that have pushed survival rates now to close to 90%, some of those treatments have actually exacerbated some of those cognitive late effects. And when we talk about that, what we're really looking at are parts of treatment that alter the way that the brain grows and develops. So basically, the children's brains prior to their diagnosis and initiation of treatment, most kids are developing in a completely typical way. They would go to school and they would be average or exceptional, or they might have some struggles unrelated to the cancer. But the two things that we really look at is some of the specific types of chemotherapy and ALL and some of the other diseases, as well as radiation therapy to the brain. These actually alter the way that the brain grows. And so we will not see a lot of the learning effects during the time of acute treatment, but 2 to 3 years out from treatment, the children begin to fall off because all of their peers are on a trajectory of growth, and it's moving forward, and they're picking up new things. And then we wind up seeing these children begin to fall off because they're not able to keep pace with their peers. The main things that we see most frequently, and I'll talk specifically about leukemia and brain tumors here.
Sure.
The main things that we see are a deterioration in the speed with which they're able to process information. And that is largely because the part of the brain, the myelin, which is basically the insulation around the nerves that help electrical messages to move quickly, that myelin fails to grow and develop and to thicken, which helps to speed things along. So the children drop off in their speed. They also have difficulty processing visual information and translating that into a motor response. And that's a fancy psychological way of saying they have trouble with reading and writing, the physical process of that, and doing it quickly. So the most frequent thing that we'll see in a child who's been treated and has a late cognitive effect is that homework takes forever. What takes other children 30 minutes to do at night is a family affair that may go 4 to 5 hours. Children do poorly on tests because they don't complete them in the time span. They have difficulty with handwriting, and particularly cursive. And so while they may have really great creativity and understanding and the ability to use a lot of language to describe things, when you ask them to write it down, it becomes the quality goes down. It's short, it's concise, and the details aren't provided. And so it looks like they're not writing well. And it really is this process of writing. Similarly, reading, while they can read the words, read them out loud, their ability to store them and retrieve them and comprehend them from reading is sometimes a real challenge. So our big issue now is how do we work around those issues.
Dr. Armstrong, what do you do in terms of intervention for you know, kids who come back after a couple years and begin to show signs of these learning disabilities or neurocognitive issues? And is there perhaps some kind of treatment that can be done proactively or preventatively, you know, before that 2 to 3 years if you know based on the patient's experience that they are a high risk for developing those issues?
Well, there are three things that we're doing. One, for the child who has the long-term learning effects, what we've found to be very promising and effective in a lot of cases, is to look at technology that can help them do workarounds. So if there's a problem with reading and writing, then emphasizing listening and speaking, getting books on tape that they can listen to rather than they have to process through the visual system, using speech-to-text dictation on a computer as a way of being able to produce the things that are in their head in a quick enough way, getting accommodation so they have more time to work, not using bubble tests. A number of these other kinds of technology supports, we've been able to see children who really were failing in school, but when those supports were put into place, they've been able to succeed not only in elementary, middle school, and high school, but we have a number of our long-term survivors who have now completed 4 years of college. Some have gone on to get a master's degree. We actually have one who's working on a PhD. At this point, but with a great deal of technology support. There's a lot of consideration about early intervention, and we're doing some work here at the University of Miami in that area, but it seems that because this is a brain development process, if we wait to do intervention when we see problems, it's probably too late. And it's very difficult to come up with an intervention that would be acceptable to a family and a child who is also getting chemotherapy, perhaps getting sick, missing school during the time of treatment. But it seems that that is the period where we have the greatest likelihood of early intervention having the benefits. I mentioned the third piece, and that is that we've been working and the success that we've had in survival of children treated for cancer really is attributable to what I would best term a miracle. And the miracle is found in the hearts of the tens of thousands of parents whose children have been diagnosed but have agreed to participate in clinical trials. And we have been able to learn, and each trial helps us to build the next trial. And really, that is the mechanism by which we've had the great success. And in that, as we've learned what some of these late effects of treatment are, we've been able to go back to the drawing board with each future clinical trial to say, could we reduce the dose of this particular drug? Can we change treatment? Can we delay radiation therapy? And we've been able to significantly reduce some of these long-term cognitive late effects by reducing or eliminating radiation therapy in some of the brain tumors and using drugs that protect against the damage that can occur to the heart and looking at ways to modify doses that affect the central nervous system. So it really is a three-pronged approach of making sure the treatment is as effective as we can get it with as few long-term toxicities as we can have, trying to do early intervention in whatever ways we can, but then using the great world of technology to do the workaround so that children can live full and productive lives as they reach adulthood.
We're taking a closer look at follow-up care and medical issues that can develop for survivors of childhood cancer ahead of a conference on the topic later this month in Fort Myers. We're talking with Dr. Daniel Armstrong with the Mailman Center for Child Development in Miami, along with Pam Wojcicki from the Golisano Children's Hospital's Pediatric Cancer Aftercare Program in the Department of Hematology and Oncology there, as well as childhood cancer survivor Julie Briggs. You can join our conversation by calling 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And Julie, you did have the bone marrow transplant, as you mentioned, the second time around. And we do know that that is associated with a higher risk for developing neurocognitive issues. Is that something that was a concern for you or the folks who were treating you or something that's really had a measurable impact on your life now?
Yeah, even from the first time I was diagnosed, everyone was always aware of the possible cognitive effects that could happen. And I have seen a couple physicians and doctors over the years for that stuff. I did have minor. I was really lucky with that type of stuff. But, I did have minor stuff when it came to math skills or testing. Some of that cognitive stuff did affect me. Mm-hmm. So we were very, very active about that, getting the accommodations in school, like Dr. Armstrong was talking about, and really taking advantage of that stuff and being proactive.
And Julie, do you worry or are you cognizant of other issues that might come up later? I mean, I mean, there's a whole host of problems. I mean, possible cardiac problems even.
I've been talked to about all the possible late-term effects. And PM's really good about kind of laying out that map of what could happen in a certain time period and exactly what treatments and the names of them I've had, you know, because it's very hard to keep track of. So she's been really good with that. I try not to dwell on it too much, though. I'm just blessed to be where I'm at and to have survived.
Tell us about the work you do now, Julie.
I currently work for the Golisano Children's Hospital, and I'm a child advocate instructor. Myself and one other instructor, we go out to Collier and Lee County schools to teach preventative health programs, such as hand washing and nutrition.
And do you think that the experience that you went through had anything to do with the line of work that you've gone into working with kids, or do you think that was going to happen anyway?
I've always liked to work with kids. I've always known that, but I think it definitely shaped the direction I've gone in my life with my career in the last couple of years.
And I guess what I want to ask is, how do you think your experience with cancer at such a young age has shaped you as a person? This might sound weird, but do you think it's shaped you in a positive way?
Oh, definitely. It was hard to go through, but no regrets, completely life-changing. I grew up really fast. I've learned to enjoy life. I wouldn't take it back for a minute.
And this question's for both Pam and Dr. Armstrong. How would you contrast how children deal with a cancer diagnosis and treatment compared to adults? And Pam, I'll start with you.
Wow, that's the reason I work in pediatrics. You know, adults, they aren't as gracious as dealing with the side effects, the alterations in their schedule, that kind of thing. Kids, it's like, would you hurry up? I have to go to the playroom. You know, I mean, they do what they have to do. They are quite honest about what they think. They'll tell you straight to your face what they think about what you're doing to them. And then they move on. And honestly, their goal is to get back to being a normal kid. And so it just makes it a lot easier to deal with that. It's the other piece of pediatrics that is, I feel, very unique and important is it's not just the patient. We deal with the whole family, the siblings, the parents, the grandparents, every doctor they want us to talk to, all of the things that happen when you have a child that gets diagnosed with cancer. And so that's a true blessing, I think, to be able to work with the family unit as a whole. Whereas in the adult world, you don't always have that ability to be able to do that.
Sure, sure. And Dr. Armstrong, your observations on that as well.
Well, I would concur with Pam. Children are incredibly resilient. Fortunately, they have young bodies that haven't been damaged by life, and so the effects are there, but perhaps not as difficult as they are for an older adult. But I think that the kids do bounce back, and the resiliency and the positive component that comes from a well-run program with a lot of support is there. I would point out that the studies that have looked at the impact, the long-term impact of at an emotional level, really falls on the parents. The parents live with this long after the child is well and back in place. And there are several studies that have looked at parents 10 to 15 years after the completion of treatment and find that they are still experiencing some emotional challenges, stress-related complications of following their child's illness. But I think it is also important on the adult side. Pam mentioned this earlier that the children, as they grow up, remain connected to the source of information about what they can expect in the future. A lot of things that we're talking about this morning, late effects in terms of survivorship, the amount of information that we have about these effects is limited to about 20 years. And the reason for that is we didn't have children who survived much more than 20 years, didn't have that in the past. So we're now beginning to look at children who are leukemia survivors who are 35 to 40 years of age. And as these children age, hopefully they will continue to be active participants in the studies of late effects, because in that way we can inform the generations that follow them and perhaps even change our therapies as we move forward. But the information is likely to not be in the general adult cancer area about late effects of childhood cancer. It's very likely to be flowing back through the pediatric centers. So programs like Pam has set up in terms of long-term follow-up will be the point at which a long-term survivor like Julie will, when she is 30 or 40 or 50 years old, will likely come back to find out what are the things that I need to be looking for, concerned about, taking steps to be able to prevent. And so this is a lifetime issue, even though our focus now and in most pediatric centers is on the child.
All right. Well, that is unfortunately all the time we have for this portion of the show. Thanks to Dr. Daniel Armstrong with the University of Miami School of Medicine's Mailman Center for Child Development. Also thanks to nurse practitioner Pam Wojcicki, who coordinates the Pediatric Cancer Aftercare Program at the Golisano Children's Hospital of Southwest Florida. And thanks to Lee Memorial Health System Child Advocate Instructor and Childhood Cancer Survivor Julie Briggs for sharing your story as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And they will all be at the Golisano Children's Hospital's first Pediatric After Cancer Experience Conference on Saturday, October 19th from 8:30 to 4:30. That's at the Sanibel Harbor Marriott Resort and Spa in Fort Myers. Information and links is at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. We're taking a short break, but when we return, what can going green do for your business? That question is at the heart of the Florida Department of Environmental Protection's second annual Greening Your Bottom Line Conference and Expo later this month in Fort Myers. Stay with us. This is WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.